For today's episode, we have our in-house virtuoso, Steve Raven, and a special guest, Mark Melman. Mark is a consultant, his firm MCA Stacking Solutions. Please tell us something about you and your firm.
MCA Stacking Solutions came about a couple years ago when I had a factoring company call me and say to me, literally, "What do you know about MCAs?" I said, "You want to avoid them at all costs." They said, "We just discovered that our third largest client, who had a credit with them of about $20 million, had $6 million in MCA debt." Long story short, I started working with their client to get them out from under their MCA debt. And the company came back stronger than ever a year later, was able to pay off the debt at that discount. And of course, the factor was thrilled. It was a great result for everybody. And one of my lawyer friends said to me, "You know, Mark, you have a business here." And that's how MCA Stacking Solutions came about.
Well, we are pleased to have you here today as an expert in merchant cash advances, commonly known as MCAs. For the listener, we have invited Mark to explain a key element, MCAs, that often cause a company to seek help in the bankruptcy court or with a restructuring agent like a CRO. In the year 1314, Dante wrote the Inferno, describing the nine circles of hell. If I'm not mistaken, number two on the list was MCAs. I think he referred to them as the gluttonous wallow in a vial, but I'm getting ahead of myself. Mark, what is a merchant cash advance?
A merchant cash advance company is the lender of last resort. It is, as I said on the ladder, the bottom rung of lending. It's when a business has nowhere else to turn, they need cash immediately, and they can go online, answer a few questions, and as a practical matter, receive the financing they're asking for, typically within 24 hours. MCAs are payday lenders for the business community rather than the individual. They put a lot of money out into the marketplace. They charge exorbitant interest rates, and it's all built around a legal fiction that it's not a loan, it's a purchase of future receivables. And the reason it is that way is to avoid the problem of usury.
For this episode, should we call it an advance or should we use a different term?
The MCA contract, if you read it, does not refer to it as a loan. In fact, it specifically says otherwise. It is, as I mentioned, a purchase of future receivables. And the way you might distinguish that is in a factoring arrangement, the factor purchases accounts receivable that exists today, and they finance against that. Whereas the MCA, theoretically, at least according to their contract, purchases a stream of receivables that will come about going forward into the future.
What doesn't make sense to me is if the MCA entity is advancing money against something that doesn't exist today, how could they be upset if the company never had a sale in the future?
Sure, they're going to be upset, but here's the thing that takes away some of that angst from the MCAs. If an MCA puts out a contract, let's say for $100,000, where the interest rate, if you calculate it, because it isn't stated in the contract, but if you calculate the APR based on what their providing and what they're expecting to receive is in excess of 100% in a very short period of time. And so the MCA doesn't expect to get back 100% of what their contracts call for. They don't need to, and they still make money.
From my perspective as a CRO, I often deal with lenders, and surprisingly enough, they don't seem to care much that their clients have taken MCA advances. When I approach them and say, you know, your client has this advance, their position is, well, they needed it, and I wasn't going to lend them anymore, so it helps them to stay in business, is what I'm guessing their thinking is.
That's a very nice philosophy, but in my experience, it doesn't work. Because again, the biggest problem is, as a practical matter, once a business owner starts taking an MCA, they find it very difficult to stop the process. And as I said, it's like going down a rabbit hole. Once you go down that hole, you can't climb out. And most of the business that I get is from referral from the lending industry, from the banks and the factors. And when they do discover that their clients have MCA debt, they aren't happy about it. You're right. They don't want to do an overadvance beyond what they're spending in purchasing receivables. But by the same token, they don't want their clients to have MCA debt.
On some MCA advances, my client signed a confession of judgment. What is that, and what impact does it have on the company?
A confession of judgment gives, in this case, the MCA the right to enter judgment without notice, merely by filing a piece of paper that's already been signed by the borrower, in this case, the business, that results in judgment being entered immediately. Most MCA contracts, regardless of where the MCA is located and regardless of where the business is located, adopt New York law as the law of the contract. And the reason is it's because historically New York law has always been creditor friendly. 2 years ago, actually, New York passed and enacted new legislation that was signed by the governor, or actually now the former governor, that did away with the right of an MCA under New York law to file a confession of judgment against any out-of-state borrower. Only New York companies. And so it effectively did away with confessions of judgment. And so MCAs lost a leverage point when New York did away with confessions of judgment. The way the MCAs try to get around that is going to other states. But again, most of the MCAs use New York law in their contracts.
So if a client has signed a confession of judgment for an MCA advance from, say, 2 years ago, is that confession of judgment void now because of the new law?
Well, the confession of judgment isn't void in the legal sense. It's just, as a practical matter, it has no use any longer. So in other words, as of September 1, 2019 and after, if you're an out-of-state business in an MCA contract under New York law and you signed a confession of judgment at any time, it can't be used against you. So the MCA is relegated to going the traditional route of complaint, service of process, right of defense, and litigation.
Let's say a company is in New York, so a judgment is entered. What would be the next step, Steve? That would be detrimental, I guess, to the company.
You do a bunch of things. Send letters to the account debtors to pay the MCA as opposed to anybody else, certainly as opposed to the company itself, the borrower, it would lead to the MCA having the ability to employ the services of the sheriff of the county where the borrower is located to, in essence, start levying on assets. That's what a judgment creditor can do, whether it's in New York or any other state. So it's a big step in the collection process.
Yeah, and what I would add to that, Steve, is the easiest thing that the MCA will do. Remember, they have the bank account information of the borrower because they, before default, were debiting that bank account daily or weekly. And so the first thing they're going to do is they're going to dock it and serve a notice of that judgment to the bank. And that will immediately, as you well know, freeze the account. And then they can move before the court to have the account released to them if there's money in the account. And so it gives the MCA tremendous leverage if they can enter judgment without notice.
So in most cases, my clients have a loan from a primary lender, let's say a conventional bank, and the lender requires that my client have checking accounts at the bank. So, A, the bank should know first that money is coming out on a periodic basis to pay the MCA. And two is, if the MCA takes or requests to have all of the money in the bank taken, wouldn't the primary lender see that, and could they stop it?
Well, to answer the first question, they certainly should see it, again, if they're diligent in the way they're managing their relationship with their borrower. And as far as the answer to the second question, they should be able to trump the MCA because, again, if the senior lender has a perfected security interest in all assets of the borrower, then they trump anybody that's behind them, including an MCA.
How does an MCA advance differ from a typical bank loan?
One that first comes to my mind is the interest rate. If you're getting conventional financing at the bank level because you qualify for it, in today's world, you're going to typically have single-digit interest rates. Whereas if you're getting MCA debt, the interest rate can be anywhere from 50% or more going into the hundreds percent. I have a client who I've been working with since December that sat down, and I think he had six contracts at that time. And when I calculated the APR cumulatively on his contracts, he was obligated to pay 275% interest. As far as the loan of money, money is money. They're getting money. The other thing that's typically different is in conventional bank financing, you're typically paying monthly. In MCA debt, you're typically paying daily, and it's an automatic debit on a daily basis out of your bank account. And so if you don't have the money in the account, you're in default because it's going to bounce. It's a much different relationship.
That sounds like very high interest rates. And I think I saw something like this in the movie Goodfellas. They talked about VIG and points and what happens if someone pays late. Is it like that with the MCAs?
This I know from reading the same articles in the newspaper that you read, Neil. There are MCAs, at least according to some of the stories I've read, use strong arm tactics. The majority of the MCAs that I've dealt with, they threaten tremendously. They scream bloody murder tremendously. They don't necessarily resort to the ultimate tactics that you would see in Goodfellas.
With those high interest rates, how do the MCAs get around the usury laws?
Well, and that comes back to the basic contract. Depending upon the state, there are still states in the United States that have no usury law. And again, let's talk, what is usury? Usury is an interest rate cap by law, by state, not federal, over and above which a contract, a loan contract, would be deemed to be void. That is not legal. And it varies from state to state. For example, California, their usury rate is 10%. Florida's usury rate is 25%. Utah has no usury rate. And so how do they get around it? The MCA world has forever called their contracts the purchase of future receivables, not a loan. And surprisingly, even though it really is a loan, courts, primarily in New York, where much of the case law has evolved, has, for the most part, until very recently, upheld these contracts as this legal fiction of the purchase of future receivables. And if the decision is that it's the purchase of a future receivable, then it's not a loan, and so therefore, usury doesn't apply.
Does the MCA have an asset if all their funding is some future receivable which doesn't exist at the moment?
In terms of description, the UCC perfects a lien on the asset. As to the question that you're asking, I'll let Mark answer that. I don't want to steal his thunder.
If you read the contract between the MCA and the business, it very much looks and feels and smells like a factoring agreement with some differences. One of the parts of a standard MCA contract includes a security agreement that says, we have a security in the assets of your company, and we have the right to perfect that security interest. And so it's not just the future receivables, it's typically whatever the assets are of the company. Now, of course, in most businesses of this nature, the assets are intangibles like receivables, as opposed to heavy equipment and other types of physical tangible property. The interesting thing is, however, that if you looked at all of the MCAs out there and all of the contracts they have, it is not common that the MCAs, even though they have the right to perfect their security interests by filing a UCC-1, do that. They don't. And I wouldn't even know what the percentage is, but I would be willing to venture a guess that less than 50% of MCA contracts have UCC-1s filed. What they'll typically do is, if they see a default, then they'll file their UCC-1. But they have that right. It's based on this concept of a future receivable and the other assets of the company.
Our resident bankruptcy expert, Steve Raven, can help your company decide if a bankruptcy is the right choice. Send an email to sraven@sol.com or by calling 973-286-6714. We hope you are enjoying this episode of Corporate Bankruptcy A to Z. Let's go back to the show.
Mark, you mentioned that the MCAs take money out of their client's bank account each day or each period. Could you elaborate on that?
Sure. When the contract is created, the MCA funds the transaction by a wire or ACH transfer into the account of the borrower. And then typically the payback of that obligation starts the next business day. And what they do is they do what's called debiting that account. That is an automatic electronic withdrawal from the account, which the business has given them the right to do. Most of them are on a daily basis, if not a weekly basis. And it could be a large sum of money.
Saturday and Sunday also count as days?
No, just business days. But it's interesting. And again, it's not uniform, but it's very common that, for example, this coming Monday is Labor Day. So it's a bank holiday. Banks are closed. You can't debit on a bank holiday. It's not unusual that many MCAs next Tuesday will take two payments instead of one to make up for the missed bank holiday. But not, it doesn't include Saturday and Sundays. It includes days Monday through Friday.
When a company finds it cannot pay its MCA debt, does it have options?
It does. One of its options is to contact me and let me do my voodoo. You have to understand who the MCAs are and what they have an appetite for. The presumption would be that in the event of a default, when the payments can't be made, the account is bouncing attempted debits, that the MCA, if they don't have the right to confess judgment, would file a lawsuit and sue the borrower. The reality is the MCAs don't have an appetite for litigation. It's, as we all know, generally, litigation, and this comes from a former trial lawyer, that's how I made my living. Litigation is expensive, time-consuming, and ultimately, the old saying is the only people who win in litigation are the lawyers, because lawyers generally get paid no matter what. But the MCAs don't want to go through litigation. And so while they'll scream bloody murder and threaten, they're looking for a way to get paid, even if not everything they're owed, rather than not getting paid at all. And that's what opens the door to the business negotiating new payment plans, long-term deals, not over the timeline of the original contract, and ultimately less than is owed. Why? Because the MCAs are better off getting paid something than not at all. They're still going to make money. And that's the bottom line.
You mentioned some of the reasons that the MCAs don't want to get involved in litigation. I would imagine, and in fact hope, that one other reason is that the MCAs may be concerned about precedent-setting decisions against them, which could kill the industry.
Are there any legal defenses for the company?
The short answer is no. You took the money, you have an obligation to pay it, so your only defenses, which we've talked about, are trying to show that it's not a purchase of future receivables, but a loan, and if then a loan at a usurious rate of interest. The only other thing that you can do is there is a clause in every MCA contract called a reconciliation clause. The borrower has the right on a monthly basis to ask for reconciliation from the MCA to calculate what the real return was to the MCA based on these future receivables. Businesses rarely even know what that clause is and how to work with it. But in the cases where where during the course of the relationship, the business asks for reconciliation, that forces the MCA to come to terms with the borrower because they can't reconcile and prove that the money they're getting has a direct relationship to the performance of the business.
I know there are lender liability laws when you're dealing with a conventional bank. And in some cases, for my clients, the lender made a loan when the company was insolvent, which again, according to what Steve taught me over the years, was subject to certain laws which said that they had to check to see if their client had viability before they made the loan. Do any of those type laws apply to MCAs?
In theory, yes. But the reality, as a practical matter, is every company that goes to an MCA, again, with their back against the wall, they can't make payroll tomorrow. They can't pay their workers' comp insurance bill. They can't pay this bill or that bill. They're insolvent by definition. But the reality is that even though they're insolvent, the MCA provides the money. And the reality is the business never really gets to the point where they're going to litigate issues like lender liability. What they're going to do as a practical matter is try to make a deal that ends up having them pay less money than is owed. And that's how these matters are more commonly resolved. Because at the end of the day, the business can't afford the legal system to litigate issues like lender liability.
Which happens to be the same answer when it comes to a conventional loan. If the borrower suspects lender liability, the borrower cannot afford the tens of thousands of dollars, if not more, to fight the bank, which has endless money to respond. So it in theory, it's a nice claim, lender liability, but in practicality, it usually doesn't go anywhere.
So I'm going to ask both of you the next question. What would be your recommendations for the company when fighting an MCA?
I think both of our responses will be the same, which is to settle on the best terms possible that are affordable, rather than getting into the fray and spending all that money on lawyers. Much as I hate to say that, but it's really what's best for the company.
I couldn't agree more. The reality is, as I've said, the MCAs are looking to make a deal. Again, they would rather have money coming in than no money at all. And so they're agreeable to what can be afforded. And that's the key. With the business, one needs to determine what they can afford to pay and then work out a deal with the MCA. And if it means stretching the timeline out a year or two, again, the MCA will be amenable to that as long as the payments are made. And that's much preferable than getting involved in litigation because, again, as Steve and I have said, it just, as a practical matter, costs too much money and doesn't really achieve a good result.
To support what you guys are saying, my experiences have been the same. I'm working on a case now where a client had about $2 million worth of MCA-type advances, and each of the MCAs were willing to work and settle. One of them was willing to accept a 20-year payout, which, of course, we settled prematurely and paid at a lesser amount, but each one was willing to work on restructuring plans.
Yep.
I hope you saved a good case study for our listeners about one of your more interesting cases.
This case was referred to me by a well-known factor, one of the largest in the country, when they discovered the client had $6.3 million in MCA debt. And they were shocked. huge company in California. All of their MCA contracts were with New York State MCA companies, but of course they were in California. And the case came to me 2 years ago in August, right as this legislation for confessions of judgment against out-of-state companies was being passed. So it was, the timing was great. I spent the first 60 days of my, and I had to develop a strategy. The client was banking at one of the top three national banks. So I said to the client, we have to change that because we need to make it more difficult for the MCAs to debit your bank account, because my plan will be to shut them off entirely and make them have to work for their money. So I spent the first 3 weeks of the engagement getting my client set up with a community bank in California, good bank. It was doing business in four of the Western states, primarily in California, where my client did business. Once we made that transition, and the company was a staffing company, so it took 3 weeks to do this because we had to make sure that not only was their operating account moved from a national bank, but most importantly, their payroll account, because that was the backbone of their business. And we had to make sure electronically everything would work on the cutover date. Took 3 weeks to do that. Meanwhile, the reps from the MCAs were calling me once I was involved, and they were screaming at me and threatening me. And, you know, and the thing I always love is how they would tell me, well, you know, we have a whole host of lawyers and we're going to turn our lawyers loose on you. I've always loved people threatening me with lawyers, considering I used to do the same thing 25 years ago when I represented banks. So it always cracks me up that they would threaten me. Like, I'd say, bring it on, guys. 3 weeks, we cut over to the community bank. And the day after, we shut off any money going to the MCAs. And at the time, cumulatively, on a weekly basis, the client had been paying $285,000 per week to the MCAs. 3 weeks, cut off to nothing. I then spent the next 9 months having them call me to try to, and only one of the companies filed suit, but it never went anywhere. It just sat on the shelf. Spent the next 9 months having them call me to negotiate a settlement. And I kept on saying, nah, too much money, boys, too much money. Finally, at the end of the 9 months, I said, here's how much we're willing to pay you. Here's how much we'll pay. But I said to them, I need a universal settlement. I'm not going to settle with one company. Everybody needs to be on board. Everybody's going to get paid the same percentage because I wanted finality. Finally, I got them all to come to the table universally. Ended up paying them 25 cents on the dollar. I think the total payback was $2.1 million, something like that. Actually, it was less. My client was able to work with their factor to advance as an over advance half the money and then paid back the over advance to the factor in 90 days thereafter. So the factor was thrilled. The client was thrilled. Their business had come back stronger than ever. They were actually making more money than they ever had. And they got rid of the $6.3 million worth of debt. And so it was a great result.
Mark, where can the listeners reach you?
The name of the company is MCA Stacking Solutions. They can find it online at www.mcastackingsolutions.com. My email address is my first initial and last name at that address. So it's mmelman, M-E-L-L-M-A-N, at mcastackingsolutions.com. And my phone number is 973-868-0767.
Do you have any concerns about the bankruptcy process and how it will impact your business? Or do you have a special topic that you would like Neil and Steve to address? Send your emails to neil@elementarybusiness.com and to sraven@saul.com, or you can follow the links in the show notes below. Corporate Bankruptcy A to Z is produced by me, Sir Isaac Smith. We would also like to give a special thanks to our show's advisor, Dan Goldstein. Thanks for listening to Corporate Bankruptcy A to Z. Axelby is a full-service software development agency who loves to dig into your project and deliver the perfect software for your business. Let us put our years of experience as business executives and expert software development to work to make your project a big success. Get started by calling 469-226-6061 or by emailing dan@axelby.com. That's dan@axelby.com. And together we'll figure out whether Axelby fits into your project. Want more content? Then head over to Patreon and become a member. On Patreon, we are working on a catalog of bonus episodes, and you can hear the answers to your questions from a business perspective instead of just a legal one. If you want more direct access to Neil and Steve, or want to supplement the education you are already getting here, then follow the links in the show notes below and become a patron today. Bonus episodes will include MCA-type loans, answers to most common questions, lenders roundtable, debtors in possession loans, and bankruptcy from the Chief Restructuring Officer's Chair. Thanks for listening, and we hope to see you over there on Corporate Bankruptcy A to Z.